today, I'm speaking with someone. If you follow the show or me at all on any sort of social media, I've been posting some stuff I'm doing with Zero Books. We're playing a role-playing game called Mothership. And the person that leads that game, the game master, the game dude, is Dr. Gene Bajlan from the University of Missouri State University. I was going to say the University of Springfield, but that's Liz. And Dr. Gene Bajlan is a historian of the Middle East. And as we're playing this game, we're not necessarily talking about all things Middle Eastern, but I had wanted to do an episode about the history of the Kurds. And the guest today, Gene Bajlan, had done that history with another friend of show, Ben Burgess, and my heart was broken because I saw Ben Burgess advertising that he did this history of this Kurdish history with Gene Bajlan. I was like, fuck, now I can't do the Kurdish history. And Gene goes, but that's behind a paywall. And I was like, ha ha ha. This is the for free.
I'm going to give you some product for free for your channel.
This will be edgier. We'll make this one edgier. I'm just kidding. I'm actually going to be on Ben's show coming up. So I'd like to introduce the audience to my friend and Zero Books gaming buddy, Dr. Mean Gene Bajlan.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's great to speak to you. It's great to be here. It's always fun to chat with you, and I'm looking forward to today.
So, you are a professor of Middle Eastern studies. You wrote a book called The Young Kurds, the Kurdish Movement Before the First World War.
That's correct.
And is this a textbook you also co-wrote, Studies in Kurdish History?
That was an edited volume of articles relating to Kurdish history by different authors, so it's kind of a collected work. It was originally published in an academic journal, but it was pretty popular, so we turned it into a book.
And when it comes to Kurdish history, I mean, Kurds have been around for some time. Do you generally start at the end of the First World War?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you're doing with Kurdish history. So, the Kurds are one of the new, many ethnic communities in the Middle East. We have Arabs, Turks, Persians, various other communities. And of course, we have Kurds. And, all these different ethnic communities, inside themselves are all like pretty diverse. There's different cultures and languages within these kind of categories that we use. But, in a sense, it makes sense to talk about the Kurds as a distinct community. And one of the reasons we, historians often focus on, the First World War and after the First World War is because prior to the First World War, the Middle East had been dominated by two multinational empires. Mm-hmm. The Ottoman Empire, which was, ruled by the Ottoman Sultan, that controlled what we know as Turkey today, what we know as Iraq, Syria, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, Arabia. Officially, it was a sovereign over Egypt. And up until the sort of late 19th century, it had also controlled large parts of southeastern Europe, the Balkan Peninsula, right? So you got this huge empire with many different ethnic communities. The Kurds are one of these communities. You've got many different religious communities. Muslims are the majority, but there are large populations of Christians and a Jewish community and so on and so forth. And then you have the Qajar Empire, which is Iran. And Iran, too, is a kind of multinational state with many different ethnic communities. Even today, Persians, speakers of the Persian language, are only perhaps about, half to 60% of the population. And there are other really big minorities. Kurds are one minority in Iran, but there are also Azerbaijani Turks, Baluchis, you know, Luris, Turkmans, you know, lots of different communities. So you have these like super diverse empires. Now, at the end of the First World War, you know, the Ottoman Empire, it gets into the war on the sides of Germany. Big mistake for the Ottomans. They're defeated. And the British and the French, they decide to carve up the Ottoman Empire. They decide to basically try and make new colonies. Now, in the part of the Ottoman Empire, the kind of core region that is Turkey today, the remnants of the Ottoman army were able to kind of militarily defeat attempts to partition that particular part of the empire. And that led to the creation of the Republic of Turkey. So the remnants of the Ottoman army and the Ottoman administration led by Mustafa Kemal Pasha, who became Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was the founder of the Republic of Turkey, they were able to successfully resist European attempts to partition that region. And what they did, they basically, initially, they fought their kind of war of resistance in the name of the Ottoman Sultan. But, you know, they very quickly, in the early 1920s, when the military victories had been won, basically got rid of the old Ottoman Sultan and declared, you know, the Ottoman Empire null and void and proclaimed Turkey a republic. Now, in the regions of the Ottoman Empire, like Iraq, Syria, Arabia, those regions had been occupied by the British during the First World War. So, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. So, you know, the British, along with their French allies, had made an agreement to, you know, split up these regions after the war. But, you know, America had become involved in the war. There was this whole discourse about, you know, this war being, the First World War being a war to liberate nations. There was Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, which included the right of nations to national self-determination. So basically, if, you know, the British and French had defeated the Ottomans 50 years earlier, they would have just turned those places into colonies. But instead, they turned them into what became known as mandates. And mandates were kind of like basically an agreement where the British and French were like, okay, we're going to set up a country here. You guys aren't like fit enough to rule yourself yet, but, you know, there's a pathway to independence. So the British and the French established a series of Arab nation states in the Middle East. So, you know, that includes Iraq, that includes Syria. There's Palestine, which is a whole kind of like different ball game because, you know, there's an indigenous Arabic majority of Christians and Muslims. But the British also make a promise to the Jewish community that is Palestine could serve as a national homeland for the Jews. So there's a whole complicated situation there. There's also, you know, the British help in the creation of Jordan, and there's some more complicated things that we don't need to go into that happen in Arabia. But what happens is the old Ottoman breaks up into a series of Arab nation states, and of course the Republic of Turkey. So a Turkish, one Turkish state and a series of Arab states. However, you know, these aren't the only communities in the Ottoman Empire. And the Kurdish community was one community that at the end of the war, many elites in that community were like, hey, you know, if we're breaking up the empire into nation states, the Kurds are their own people with their own culture, history, and language and territory. Therefore, we would, you know, we want to have a nation state. And in 1920, one of the agreements, the Treaty of Serfs, actually included a provision that would allow for the creation of a Kurdish nation state. But what happens is the northern parts of the Kurdish inhabited regions of the Ottoman Empire, they remain under the control of the Ottoman military at the end of the war. And when Mustafa Kemal leads his rebellion and establishes the Republic of Turkey, he ensures that these like northern areas of Kurdish inhabitation remain part of the Republic of Turkey. Meanwhile, the British, for a variety of different reasons, want to include the southern districts of Kurdish inhabitation, what Kurds call southern Kurdistan, into the newly formed state of Iraq. Iraq was a predominantly Shia country. The British were very suspicious of Shia Islam and preferred Sunni Islam. They imported a king from Arabia, the Hashemites dynasty, who was a Sunni. And the problem would have been is that, you know, without the Kurdish component, Sunnis would have been a very small minority in Iraq. But the inclusion of the Kurds, who are predominantly Sunni, increased the proportion of Sunnis in the new Iraqi state. There were also economic and military reasons to want to include those regions. It would make Iraq more defensible from threats coming from the north, not just Turkey, but possibly the Soviet Union. So although, you know, Kurds had been at times promised a state and Kurdish activists had pushed for a state, at the end of the First World War, the Kurds did not receive a state. Thus, the Kurdish community came to be divided between these new states that had been created out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. It's a bit complicated, but I hope that kind of gives you a kind of overview of why we focused. Good
brief history. That's actually pretty excellent. And so there is no Kurdistan, right? We have Kurds living in all these, what you said, so northern Syria.
Yep, northern Syria, northern Iraq, southeastern Turkey, and northwestern Iran, right? So all these regions are inhabited by Kurds. And they're a kind of contiguous region that Kurds call Kurdistan. And the region has been called Kurdistan for a long, you know, for a long period of time. It has been used as an official name at times. The Ottomans used it in the 19th century as the name of a province. The province of Kurdistan didn't cover all the Kurdish regions of the Ottoman Empire, but it covered many of them. There's a province in Iran that uses the term Kurdistan. Today in Iraq, the official name of the autonomous regional Kurdish, like autonomous region in the north of the country, is the Kurdistan region of Iraq. So that's official usage as well. Interestingly, the term Rojava, which is used in relation to Syria, Rojava means west. And the reason they call that part west is because from the Kurdish perspective, that's the west of Kurdistan, if that makes sense to you. So Kurds use the term, you know, the term has been used formally as a name of provinces or autonomous regions at various times in history. But in a general sense, Kurds use it to refer to the homeland in a kind of cultural and geographical sense, although it does not refer to a specific nation state today. There's no, you know, Republic of Kurdistan.
And there was, would you say Kurdish genocide during the, I almost said Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein years?
Yeah, there have been various campaigns throughout the 20th century that could be labeled genocide or genocidal, but perhaps one of the most severe of these campaigns occurred in the late 1980s, the so-called Al-Anfal campaigns. Al-Anfal is a reference to the verse from the Quran that discusses the spoils of war. So basically, during the Iran-Iraq War, you know, in the 1980s, there were Kurdish populations in both Iraq and Iran. So during the course of the war, the Iraqis supported Iranian Kurdish insurgents against the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the Iranians supported Iraqi Kurdish insurgents against Saddam Hussein's government. But in 1988, that war came to an end. And this sort of gave Saddam Hussein the opportunity to consolidate power against those Kurdish communities. And one of the ways that the Kurdish movement in Iraq had been able to sustain itself was that it was generally a kind of popular movement that had support in the countryside, right? So basically, these campaigns involved the sort of massacre and depopulation of the rural districts of Kurdistan, the movement of populations to kind of government-controlled villages that could be surveilled relatively easy, and the, you know, the mass execution of individuals associated with insurgent groups in Iraq. And, you know, all, you know, various weaponry was used in this, including chemical warfare. You know, chemical weapons were used in this. And, you know,
So popular a few years ago in Syria, right? The sarin gas, right? A lot of that was used over there too, wasn't it?
In Kurdistan, mustard gas was used, but yes, there was a variety of different gas is that we used. You know, like poison gas technology, you know, people seem have this image that it's some kind of very sophisticated technology, but you know, they've been using that shit since the First World War. So, you know, it's relatively, it can be literally as easy as dumping chemicals out of a helicopter.
And this seems so long ago now, but it was only 2019. President Trump at the time pulled a bunch of troops out of the northern Syria region, and there was some pushback that he got from the U.S., from a lot of people, actually, from the right, surprisingly, that we were leaving our allies, our Kurdish allies that were helping us fight ISIS.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So this is like, this is kind of the complexities of the Kurdish question that, you know, like people don't get, right? You know, and can confuse people. So when we talk about the Kurds, you know, in a political sense, you know, obviously, you know, there are political divisions amongst the Kurds, but they're also, we can also think of the Kurds as having very distinct movements. Like the Kurds in Iraq are like organizationally and politically very distinct from the Kurds in Syria. And there's actually a funny bit where Trump was talking to the Kurdish leader of Iraq. So the Kurdish leader in Iraq. And it was like super obvious from what Trump was saying that he was talking about stuff in Syria. He didn't realize that this guy had nothing to do with the political leadership of the Kurds in Syria. He was like talking about stuff in Syria, and the Iraqi Kurdish leader didn't have anything to do with that. So yeah, the Kurds in Iraq, and I'm just dialing back on this just to put this in context about Syria. So the Kurds in Iraq have a long history of working with the United States. From, you know, like there were relations in the 1970s, then in the 1990s. And of course, the Kurds in Iraq supported the Americans in the invasion of Iraq. So there's a long kind of history of kind of cooperation with the Iraqi Kurds. And of course, in a general sense, that means that the military in general, many people are just like positively inclined to the Kurds. In a general sense, not specifically the Iraqi Kurds. They're like, oh, Kurds are cool. They're our allies and things like that. And the Iraqi Kurdish political movement is like pretty well established. They have an officially recognized autonomous region. They have like, you know, if you go to the north of Iraq, it's like its own like independent country, right? You know, they don't have complete independence, but it's largely autonomous schools. They have their own corrupt leadership and so on and so forth. They have their own military, the Peshmerga. So they have, you know, like, and they have like good relations with politicians in the United States. And the Iraqi Kurdish movement in a general sense is kind of like very, very neoliberal, like economics, conservative politics kind of. They're secular, but they're like not particularly radical. Now in Syria, the Kurdish movement is a lot more radical, a lot more left wing, and this is why the Kurds in Syria have been a kind of controversial topic amongst the left in America, is because some people see the Kurds in Syria who in 2014. Forged an alliance with the United States within the context of the fight against ISIS. You know, some on the left see as that as the Kurds as becoming stooges of American imperialism, whereas others on the left look at the kind of social revolutionary nature of the Kurdish movement in Syria, and they see that as like a political experiment in sort of libertarian socialism that is worth supporting. And they see the alliance with the United States is one born out of necessity, because, you know, when you have ISIS breathing down your neck, there aren't many political options. So that political movement in Syria has different historical origins. Many of the Kurdish fighters in Syria originally were part of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which fought in Turkey. You know, Syria's Kurdish population was marginalized. But the Assads were able to direct the action, direct the energy of many Syrian Kurds towards Turkey by allowing the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which, you know, fought against Turkey to recruit Syrian Kurds to go fight against the Turkish government. And so, you know, there was a close relationship between the Syrian government and the Kurdistan Workers Party from, you know, the foundation of the organization in the late 70s and early, well, particularly in the 80s. And, you know, the leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, he was living in Syria and then in Lebanon. And he was, you know, he was basically living there until the late 1990s when he was forced out because Turkey threatened to launch military action against Syria and Syria couldn't really do much about it. So the PKK was a very left-wing and almost anti-American movement for a while. Turkey was a NATO ally. The PKK, when it was founded, you know, was this kind of strong socialist, you know, fighting for a united, independent, and socialist Kurdistan organization that, you know, fought not only against Turkey but also all the landowning elites and groups that it saw as cooperating with the Turkish regime. So many Syrian Kurds were recruited in the 80s and 90s to go fight, you know, by the PKK to go fight in Turkey. But within the context of the Syrian civil war, the Syrian regime basically left the Kurdish regions to the PYD, which was a kind of offshoot of the PKK, a kind of sister organization that sort of focused on Syrian affairs, Syrian Kurdish affairs. And that group basically came to dominate that part of the country. And, you know, the irony is the United States, including from the administration of Bill Clinton onwards, had provided both military and intelligence support for Turkey in its fight against the PKK. But within the context of the fight against ISIS, the United States made an alliance with the PKK's sister organization, the PYD, this kind of Syrian, you know, the Turks call it the Syrian branch, but it's very much its own political party now. But this kind of Syrian sister organization that emerged in Syria, and, you know, that caught the interest of a lot of Westerners because the PYD mobilized large numbers of women. Now, if you're a follower of Kurdish history and politics, that's like nothing new. The PKK has a long history of women fighters in its ranks, and other left-wing Kurdish parties have had Kurdish fighters. Komala, which was an Iranian Kurdish political organization, had female fighters in the 1970s. So this is nothing new, but, you know, it was something that certainly captured the imagination of, you know, many wide-eyed Western journalists, this image of these young girls in their late teens and early 20s taking up AK-47s to fight against, you know, ISIS, you know, one of the most brutal and reactionary Islamist organizations, you know, on the planet. So this alliance,
the propaganda of the women fighters a little later.
Yeah. So this alliance kind of emerged in 2014, and Obama, who was, Obama had like not wanted to get involved in Syria, you know, when the Syrians launched those gas attacks, across the red lines, the America was able to avoid getting involved in the conflict. But ISIS presented a new problem because ISIS, as you might remember, in the summer of 2014, invaded Iraq, seized about a third of the country, and threatened to destabilize the entire region. So the Americans, you know, had to re-entered the region to fight ISIS, and this meant fighting ISIS not only in Iraq but in its bases of operation in Syria. The Americans get involved in the Syrian civil war in an alliance with the YPD and its militia organizations, the YPG. There's a whole bunch of acronyms. Sorry, I guess.
No, I noticed the acronyms don't, for me, they don't equal, you know, like YPG is in like the Young People's Guerrillas. It stands for something.
Yeah. So yeah, So basically, you have this alliance form. Now, the Americans had initially not really wanted to get into bed with the Kurds, or they were reticent. They were hoping that Turkey, their NATO ally, would be able to kind of launch you know, be able to support a kind of counteroffensive and take the lead in fighting ISIS. But, you know, Turkey's attempts basically failed. Turkey also had left the borders open to allow fighters from across Europe and Asia to come and fight in Syria. And many of those fighters had gone on to fight for ISIS. So, like, the failure to come to kind of an arrangement with Turkey on how to counter ISIS led the Americans into this alliance with the Syrian Kurds, this left-wing organization that has links to a group that the United States had had designated a terrorist organization. You know, the leader who I mentioned, Abdullah Öcalan, he was captured by Turkish authorities while on the run in 1999. And he was captured in part because of American intelligence tip-offs, right? So you have this group with links to an organization that the Americans designated a terrorist organization, becoming allies in the war against ISIS. And, you know, this is like a real big contradiction in American policy. And as it turns out, you know, the Kurdish forces in Syria and then the umbrella organization, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, which includes the Kurds as well as Arab fighters who begin to be integrated into the into sort of the Syrian Kurdish-led military organization. These groups prove pretty successful in combating ISIS, and with American air support, they're able to push ISIS out of most of northeastern Syria. They take over the capital, ISIS capital of Raqqa. They push them, you know, out of all these territories, and of course, the growing power of the Syrian Kurds, which the Turks view, the Turkish government views as with deep suspicion, leads to increasing Turkish hostility to the Kurds in Syria. And this is in part, and to make this more confusing, this is in part related to events taking place in Turkey at the time. Prior to 2015, the Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan had been engaging in a peace process with the PKK, this sister organization of the PYD and the YPG in Syria. So the relationship was not warm, but there was some kind of relationship between the two sides. Syrian Kurdish political leaders traveled to Turkey. You know, there was negotiations with Turkish intelligence. So we have this, so there's this peace process going on in Turkey, which also sort of helps the Syrian Kurds consolidate power because, you know, Turkey is not immediately hostile to them. However, in 2015, the Kurdish political party or the Kurdish-backed political party in Turkey, the HDP, wins a major electoral victory. You know, they're able to increase their vote to over 10%. Which means that they're able, despite not being being still the third/fourth largest party in Turkey, they're able to deny Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president, well, now president, then prime minister, a majority in the parliament. And this leads the Erdogan to sort of abandon the Kurdish peace process and try and consolidate a new base of support on the Turkish nationalist right. And that Turkish nationalist right is deeply hostile to any peace process with the Kurds inside Turkey and deeply hostile to the Kurds in Syria, who they see as being kind of puppets of the PKK, this, you know, Kurdish insurgent, left-wing insurgency group that has fought against the Turkish government since 1984. So what happens after this? Relations with the Syrian Kurds increasingly deteriorate. Turkey begins to occupy parts of Syria, at first regions that the Syrian Kurds had not occupied. But then in 2017, the Turks attacked the region of Afrin, which was a Kurdish-controlled region in the north, in the northwest of Syria. And, you know, the Turks invade the region, depose the local Kurdish government, and, you know, ethnically cleanse most of the Kurds from the region, and are basically ruling that region through, former Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters who they've kind of welded together into their own kind of pro-Turkish militia. Now, that wasn't really much to do with the Americans, because Afrin was a region that was actually under the protection of the Russians. So when the Russians pulled out, the Turks were able to go. What happened in 2019 is Trump really did a dirty on the Syrian Kurds. So, you know, tensions had been rising for months between the Syrian Kurds and Turkey. Turkey was increasingly, you know, stating its intentions openly to attack Rojava, the Syrian Kurdish region. And this wasn't new. You know, there had been flashpoints before. But, you know, Turkey, you know, while willing to fight against, you know, the Kurds, was less willing to engage against the Americans. So, you know, a couple of years earlier, there had been some tensions over the control of the town of Manbij. This is a small town, and, you know, the Turks were very upset that Kurdish forces had occupied the region. They threatened to attack the region, but because the Americans placed troops there, you know, the Turks' blusters came to nothing. So, you know, there were attempts by the kind of foreign policy establishment to de-escalate tensions between the Syrian Kurds and Turkey. And this included, you know, the American administration persuading the Syrian Kurds to dismantle their fortifications on the Turkish border. And,
really?
You know, yeah, so, you know, the Syrian Kurds are like, we don't want to fight Turkey, so we'll dismantle these things. We're happy to have, you know, observers there. And then all of a sudden, Trump has a telephone call with Erdogan and pulls back the American forces from the border, and Turkey attacks and starts, you know, it attacks with basically these kind of ex-ISIS, ex-Al-Qaeda kind of jihadist militias that it's kind of welded together, sends them across the border. They get engaged in campaigns of murder, rape, decapitations, you know, because these aren't trained soldiers, you know, like armies are brutal, but, you know, some of these, we have some pretty horrific pictures. So, you know, yeah, a lot of people are, you know, even though they're not ideologically sympathetic to the Syrian Kurds, are like, you know, we're doing the dirty on the guys who provided the ground troops in the fight against ISIS. Now, Trump kind of reverses that, because he gets like a lot of blowback, not just from the establishment, but from the evangelical base. And there's like a whole ton of different stories around this. There are like evangelical groups that, like, basically the Kurds in Syria had a relatively liberal policy towards like Christians. You know, it's not to say all the Christians in the region are like super happy, but there are several Christian communities, Syriacs, Assyrians, Armenians living in the region. And, you know, like Turkey is viewed with great suspicion and hostility by evangelicals, especially because of the basically the Turkish government held an evangelical missionary, Andrew Brunson, hostage a couple of years back. So the evangelicals don't like Turkey, and they, you know, so Trump got blowback from a lot of different directions from his own side, right? And so he kind of reversed his position, but, you know, a lot of the damage was done. You know, certain territories were taken, and the Syrian Kurdish political project was weakened once again. So, you know, it wasn't a complete disaster, but it was definitely a major blow. And yeah, it kind of sucked for many Kurds. Some people on the left were like, you know, well, you know, it's good that American troops are leaving. But, you know, many on the left were like, you know, the positioning of a couple of hundred American troops on the Syrian Turkish border was preventing a conflict. It's not really a success for anti-imperialism if the Americans withdraw and then NATO ally Turkey moves in and starts massacring people. You know, it's like, at best, it's a sidestep, right? So, yeah.
Was that your perspective on the whole thing too?
Yeah, that was my perspective. You know, like, a lot of people were like, well, you can never trust the Americans. We told you so. And it's like, you know, and I wrote about this at the time. I was like, yeah, this policy of allying with the Americans is always going to be a contradiction because, you know, the Turkish government is hostile to the Syrian Kurds, and at some point that contradiction is going to come to a head, And when that happens, it's very likely that Turkey will choose Ankara over its Kurdish allies. So nobody was like, or I don't think many people were going into this saying that, oh, damn, from now on, the Americans are a sure thing. But, you know, when you're fighting ISIS and you don't have, you know, you don't have any other kind of options for military alliances, you know, beggars can't be choosers, right? So, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to critique that strategy. But, you know, people are like, well, we told you so. And this is also a great success because Trump is withdrawing troops. But, you know, he moved those troops to Saudi Arabia straight afterwards. And, you know, was
troops really withdrawn? I'm sorry, Gene. That they weren't really withdrawn. They were just moved over.
Yeah, like some troops were moved to the. I don't know the details exactly of the deployments, but well, actually, I believe some were moved back to the American bases in Iraq, and I think after that, some of those same troops were actually redeployed to Saudi Arabia. I think one of the funny parts was that, you know, Syria has some oil, and that oil had been under the control of the Syrian Kurds. And I think when Trump realized that there was some oil, he immediately made sure that American troops were redeployed to the region or remained in the region to protect the oil. So, you know, you have this bizarre situation taking place with that. So Trump's policy was kind of incoherent. It seems like basically Erdogan got on the phone with him, and Erdogan was like, according to John Bolton, Erdogan was like really able to impress Trump, because like Erdogan is like a guy who does these big rallies and stuff like that. Like Erdogan is way smarter than Trump, and he's got like way more like strategic thinking. He's not like, Erdogan's not like some political genius, but compared to Trump, he is. And he was very good at like persuading Trump that, no, like, you got to trust me. You know, like, I can get big rallies. Kurds love me. Don't worry about it. We got this. We're fighting terrorists. And Trump got rolled. And yeah, people were like, bro, what are you doing? This is like super embarrassing that our allies are getting massacred. Even if we don't care about our allies, it's like, you know, it's just bad PR, right? So, yeah. So like some people were just like, this is just not good PR, because who the hell's going to trust us in the future if like such a naked betrayal happens? Like, you know, you could talk about like, oh yeah, they helped the Syrian Kurds out, but then 15 years down the line, somebody comes and murders them. Like, well, you know, maybe the reason for that is an American betrayal, but it's not so immediate as this one, where literally the Americans tell the Syrian Kurds, take down your border fortifications. Trump is on the phone to Erdogan and then green lights the invasion of the region. So Trump basically bungled this, and he got blowback. And I think he was surprised about the blowback. I think he was expecting people to go, oh yeah, this is great. Good job withdrawing from this endless war. But for a whole variety of reasons, he got criticism from both the right and the left.
Yeah, I did see that. And I remember that. I also remember some of the things that he would say with the withdrawal. And you could tell he didn't really understand anything that you've just talked about right now. Because I remember him saying, you know, these people have been fighting for a long time, hundreds of years. This has nothing to do with us. It's like, it's not that simple. And you're trying to make it about some silly religious thing when it's way deeper than that.
Yeah, no, that is fucking 100% correct. I mean, like, you know, these kind of like religious narratives and like ethnic conflict narratives, they're like super easy to understand, but they're also like super inaccurate. So they don't really help us much, right? You know, Kurds have not been fighting Turks forever. And, you know, Kurds and Arabs and, you know, it's like there has been violence and conflict, but like just to put it down to like these ancient hatreds makes no sense and really obfuscates like what the real dynamics promoting conflict are, you know?
It's also very offensive to think that people are going to fight for hundreds of thousands, or not hundreds of thousands, but like hundreds of years over, you know, my God's better than your God.
Yeah, like most people don't care, I don't think.
No.
Most people, I mean, like take, for example, ISIS, right? So on one hand, like, yeah, ISIS is an Islamist organization, right? But the average ISIS fighter was not somebody like deeply schooled in Islamic theology, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was some young guy who like some imam or some sheikh tells them, like, okay, you go murder these Christians, or you go murder these Yazidis, or you go murder these Shias because they're non-believers, and that is the way to get into heaven, and here's a bunch of meth, right? You know, you know, so, like, it's it, there's no deep, like, you know, it's like religion in that case is simply like skins and shirts. It's like a football team. And, you know, that's how religion is even in the United States. You know,
I agree.
You know, when people are like, I'm a Christian, it's like, okay, like, what do you do? It's like, yeah, some people go to church, right? Some people pray, but, like, other people, it's just like, I'm a Christian, and, you know, I just don't like being Muslims, yeah? But, like, they don't actually practice anything to do with Christianity. I think there was a couple of studies on the Trump voters who defined themselves as Christians and even evangelicals, but didn't actually, like, practice on a day-to-day basis religion.
No, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, I've gotten to know, as we were talking off air, some people that are, you know, somewhat hardcore in their faith, that some were Trump supporters. But if you're really hardcore in your faith, there's not much that Donald Trump is saying outside of, like, overly racist shit that you would probably agree with.
That's true. I know a bunch of former evangelicals, or, like, people who come out of that Christian conservative tradition, who are just like, I'm out, man. All the stuff that we were told about, like, character mattering and behavior mattering, seems that didn't really matter. It was just like being, you know, it was just a cover for being, like, kind of racist.
Kind of homophobic. Yeah, no, it really is. Which is why I wanted to have you come on here and talk about this, because when the narrative kind of gets spun a little easier, because when you're trying to explain this, you're going to go, you kept saying, like, this is a little complex, and let me give you some context, because you can't just say as simple as the North didn't have slaves and the South had slaves and there was a war over slavery. Like, even that is overly simplistic over.
Yeah, I mean, like, I totally agree. I mean, like, you know, it's not like all these, like, people fighting in the Union Army were, like, super woke, and they were like, bro, we've got to totally have, like, you know, like, black people coming down, you know, like, they can come fuck my wife, and, you know, like, they can date my daughter and shit like that. No, these guys were racist, but, you know, a lot of them were. A lot of them became de-raced, you know, through their experience of, like, meeting and fighting to liberate black people, became less racist. But a lot of them were just fighting in the Union Army for A, money, maybe, B, because they didn't like the fact that slave owners didn't have to pay their workers, for a whole load of reasons that had nothing to do, or, you know, for the fact that they didn't like the fact that there was a black population in the country, and if they believed that they got rid of slavery, they would you know, they would be able to, you know, like, have a white ethno state of, like, small farmers. So there's a whole load of reasons why people vote. It's not like, yeah, like, the good old Union boys were all, like, I mean, you know, all, like, super.
This,
like,
ain't right.
Yeah, super, super racially sensitive. I'm sure a couple of them were saying the N-word, you know, like, and stuff like that.
Even for that matter, it's not like every soldier that went overseas to World War II from the United States went there because, you know, like, I'm going to do the right thing. There was a fucking draft.
Yeah, there was a draft. Right, exactly. And, you know, what they did was good and heroic. But, you know, like, people do things for different reasons, you know.
I do a show with a group of now leftist post 9/11 combat vets.
Yeah,
and they're called Flank Vets, and you know, they talk about the poverty draft in the United States all the time. That a lot of them went to fight because they needed money. They didn't have money. They came from these towns that there wasn't much going on.
Yeah,
I mean, the one I talked to is a recruiter.
That's that's classic. You see, I mean, you see that even in like the Iraqi insurgency had its own political economy, right? You know, mm-hmm. You know, like, there was money flowing and there were opportunities to make money fighting against the Americans as well as for them, you know, like, money. So yeah, like, you know, you have ideological warriors and then you have, like, a whole, like, spectrum of people who are doing things for a whole like mixed motivations, right?
And it's silly to think that, you know, everyone is fighting on the behalf of their God.
Yeah, it's silly to think everyone is fighting on behalf of their God. Like, you know, in, you know, ISIS, in one way, you know, like people want to like compare them to, you know, all these like, you know, radical like Islamic sects from throughout Islamic history, or they want to compare them to the Nazis and things like that. But, you know, one good way to look at ISIS is like Chicago gangs, right? It's just a bunch of young people who want to live a thug life. I don't know, like who think, who see that as being a kind of way of doing it, right? They wanted to, like,
perspective, actually.
You see them, like, for example, there's videos of them talking about the rape that they conduct and the sexual slaves that they buy and things like that. And when they're talking, they're just talking about, yeah, you know, I'm going to get this hot one. I'm going to pay $50 for her. I'm going to fuck her every day and stuff like that. Just talking like that. That doesn't sound like the words of like a super religiously pious guy.
No.
It's a guy who's like, who's like dark side is coming out and is doing things for like very like, you know, like for kind of like personal gratification.
And which is interesting because it's never the narrative that you hear when you even watch like mainstream kind of bigger corporate media. It always stems from, and then the propagandics movies, which is, you know, another thing I wanted to get into was like, you know, the propaganda that the Clinton family is getting behind. But there's always some sort of like magical reason almost that the good, quote unquote, good people are fighting. And another thing I wanted to ask you about, did you ever follow the White Helmets movie?
I did not follow the White Helmets stuff very closely. I kind of know a bit about it. I never saw the movie. The guy killed himself in Istanbul, I believe, like not so long ago, like the head of the White Helmets.
Oh.
Yeah, he killed himself. You know, because like, I don't know the truth about the White Helmets, but, you know, that they were pretty controversial, and that, you know, there was a lot of personal attacks on that guy and about like what they were doing and whether they were. Because like the Syrian opposition is like it basically got taken over by like the worst elements of sort of Islamists eventually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so like a lot of people, you know, see the White Helmets as being kind of like a CIA intelligence front operation that is out there supporting Islamist terrorists. They're not really this humanitarian organization. I like have like no idea on the specifics of them or how to judge them or anything like that. But if they were like genuinely out there doing that work because they felt the need to do it, I can imagine you would probably want to kill yourself after you've been accused of being like a CIA stooge with blood on your hands for like 5 years. So, you know, I don't know the truth behind it, but, you know, yeah, everything gets politicized within the context of a civil war.
So where are the Kurdish people now in 2021 in the year of, you know, another year of COVID?
Yeah, like, well, the Kurds, it's like things have been kind of going down, like things kind of peaked for the Kurds in around 2014, and then things have been going down ever since. So like in Turkey, the Kurdish movement, the HDP, the parliamentary sort of movement is basically being repressed. You know, there are wave after wave of arrests on completely nonsensical charges, completely made up charges. You know, European Court of Human Rights have called on for the release of Kurdish political leaders, but, you know, the Turkish government just keeps them locked up. And, you know, the main figure that we might point to is Selahattin Demirtas, who was a former presidential candidate and the leader of the HDP. And, you know, Erdogan locked him up because, you know, he was a young, charismatic guy. And although he wasn't immediately a threat to Erdogan's power, I think Erdogan saw someone who might have the potential to be a threat in the long term. The leader of the main opposition party, in Turkey is called the Republican People's Party, Kılıçdaroğlu. He's like super incompetent, super uncharismatic. And in fact, the other day he gave a speech in which he was, you know, appealing to voters saying, look, I tell the AKP voters, what have I ever done to obstruct anything the AKP, the ruling party, has wanted to do? So people are like, this guy's useless. He's like a controlled opposition. So Demirtaş was seen as this kind of young, charismatic figure, but he's been put in jail. So in Turkey, it's looking pretty grim. After making gains in the parliament and the peace process of the, you know, early 2010s, you know, everything seems to have gone back to the old sort of method of military repression and political repression. In Iraq, things are kind of at a status quo. In 2017, the Iraqi Kurds made a massive miscalculation, a very stupid blunder. They held a referendum on independence, and that led to a brief skirmish with the Iraqi central government. But, you know, the Kurds lost a bit of territory, but now, you know, things are very much as they were. The, you know, Kurdish autonomy in Iraq is pretty secure, right? It's pretty, you know, like well-established. Kurdish political leaders in Iraq have connections and they're rich. They're rich as hell. They're sending their kids to university in the U.S. They're buying houses in Beverly Hills. It's a good times if you're a member of the Iraqi Kurdish elite. Not so good if you're a member of the Iraqi Kurdish population because the economy has gone to shit because of the low price of oil and because of the COVID crisis. In Iran, the Kurdish population is facing continued repression. There's been a recent, I just saw on Twitter today, there'd been another round of arrests of Kurdish cultural figures and activists. So in Iran, there's a long history of repression. And then in Syria, you know, things have kind of stabilized. The Syrian Kurds lost territory in 2017 and 2019, but things seem to have stabilized. And, you know, for the Syrian Kurds, things might look up because the Biden administration and a lot of people in Washington are kind of sick of Turkey, right? They're like sick of what Turkey gets up to. So, you know, Turkey has been able to behave very aggressively in the Middle East, much more so than countries like Iran. You know, people focus on Iranian expansion, but actually Turkey has been like very active. And the reason it's able to do this is because it's an American ally. But it seems that the relationship will cool under Biden. You know, Erdogan had a good relationship with Trump. Biden does not have a positive relationship with Erdogan. And Biden is actually probably the most overtly pro-Kurdish president that the United States has had.
Really?
Yeah. He,
was it the reason for him to want to go in there initially in the late 90s?
No, I don't think that's the reason. That's his reason. But like after the Iraq war, he was one of the people who called for, you know, creating a big Kurdish autonomous region in the north of Iraq. He had this thing called the Biden Plan. You know, he negotiated with Turkey to de-escalate conflict with the Syrian Kurds. And I forget her name, but one of his advisors was an American of Kurdish origin as well. So he has some kind of sympathy towards the Kurds. How that plays out in politics and practice, you know, that's a different question, but, you know, it is what it is.
Do you think under the Biden administration, maybe one of his big foreign policy deals will be to actually, because this, from everything I've been reading, there's what, 30 million Kurds that don't have a true country. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Kurdistan becomes a country under the Biden administration, or that he tries to make that happen?
No, I doubt it. Like Americans are like most countries are very reticent about redrawing boundaries. You know, it happens for specific reasons at specific times. But, you know, it's not like a super common thing, right? And, you know, from the American perspective, America doesn't have a Kurdish policy. It has a policy towards Turkey. It has a policy towards Syria. It has a policy towards Iraq. It has a policy towards Iran. And the Kurds are always going to be a kind of second thought in that. Because, you know, even if the United States says, okay, you know, we want to have an independent Kurdistan just for the Iraqi part, just for the Iraqi Kurds, that's going to create complications for the relationship with Turkey, right? So America is always going to try and, you know, my notion is that America will, you know, it might more actively pursue trying to, you know, foster agreements between, like, let's say, for example, the Syrian central government and the Syrian Kurds, or Baghdad and the Iraqi Kurds, or even Ankara and the Turkish Kurds. It might try and help become involved in resolving those issues, but it's never going to support Kurdish independence in the sense of the creation of a large independent Kurdish nation states. New countries, new sovereign nation states can very rarely, and I can't think of an example at all, win their independence purely through their own efforts. It always involves some kind of foreign intervention and foreign recognition. The United States of America would have been crushed on the boot of good King George had it not been for the French, Spanish, and Dutch interventions, right? Countries need, the Kurds just don't have a great power around the world that has an interest in supporting their independence. So, short answer is no.
That's rough. And briefly, Rojava. Yeah. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, Rojava. Yeah.
Rojava was pretty popular around that same time that Trump was talking about pulling out, because it is a socialist region, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a libertarian, anarchistic, socialistic experiment. The governing ideology is what they call democratic confederalism. And, you know, this is kind of the idea that you devolve power to, you know, local municipal governments. It draws on the ideas of Murray Bookchin, who was a Brooklyn-born anarchist. Mm-hmm. And Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, who kind of adapted Bookchin's work to the Middle East. Yeah, the ideology emphasizes women's emancipation, which means, you know, women's participation in government, a system of co-leaders, very strong emancipatory politics. And, you know, this ideology has proved popular not only amongst Kurds, but also some Syrian Arabs who are like, hey, you know, a lot of Syrian Arab women are like, this female emancipation where I get to carry a gun and I get to be not doing the drudgery of housework all the time, it's pretty cool, right? So it's kind of, it's got female emancipation, and it's also, you know, very much focused on environmentalism and cooperative economics. So it's not entirely anti-capitalist per se, but it is a sort of radical anarchistic system that has been established in the region.
Yeah, because I remember some friends, we were talking about that, that's 2 years ago. Seems like it's been forever. Kind of the Rojava experiment, and could it work elsewhere?
You know, like, that's the big thing that supporters of Rojava say, you know, that idea. Like, so one of the interesting things about Rojava is that, like, unlike in Iraq, the Iraqi Kurds are like very much like old school nationalists, right? They want to have an independent state, right? Geopolitics means they can't have an independent state, so they want kind of as much autonomy as they can, and they want their autonomous region to look like a nation state as much as possible. You know, its own flag, all that jazz, right? Mm-hmm. But like, although many of the like grassroots amongst the Syrian Kurds are like Kurdish nationalists who are like really into Kurdish language, culture, and so on and so forth. Like, the official ideology is anti-nationalist, and it sees democratic confederalism and this kind of like radical devolution of political power to municipalities and local governments, and the creation of kind of autonomous cantons, they call them, sees that as a kind of way to resolve the national question in the Middle East. You know, the argument of Abdullah Öcalan is that, you know, the nation state as a model of political organization has failed, and we need to come up with a new model. So many advocates, like I have a friend, he's from London, Greek Cypriot. You know, he wants to see the reunification of, North and South Cyprus, the Turkish part of Cyprus and the Greek part of Cyprus. And he is attracted to democratic confederalism because he sees it as a way that the Greek and Turkish communities could live together in peace, you know, as kind of in an alternative system, an alternative system that is kind of anti-nationalist. Now, how far this is going to be a success in the long term, you know, I don't know. I can't make predictions and things like that, but it is certainly an interesting sort of ideological sort of trend. And it's not completely new in the Middle East, right? At the beginning of the 20th century, you know, many groups in the Ottoman Empire, you know, they were keen to advance the culture and language and of their community, to have their communities be successful. But they didn't necessarily want to have an independent state. They hoped to have live within a kind of cosmopolitan society in which, you know, people's rights were guaranteed by a constitution. So, you know, they didn't want necessarily to have like pure kind of ethno states, but, you know, aspired to living alongside other peoples in relative peace in a constitutional order. So the notion that Middle Eastern people, you know, all want their own nation state and can't live together is not necessarily true. There are, you know, democratic confederalism as advocated by Rojava and its supporters is one model, but, you know, there have been other models in the past, constitutionalism, you know, socialism, and so on and so forth.
All right. That was the episode with Mean Gene Bajlan. You can catch Mean Gene, Doug Lane, and his kids playing on Zero Quest on Zero Books YouTube channel, where we play the Mothership game. It's a lot of fun. You can also catch, if you missed the Tuesday live stream of This Is Revolution, This Is Revolution, you can catch us on the Zero Books YouTube channel. I will have a link in the description of the show to our YouTube if you want to be more interactive with the show. If you can catch it on Tuesday night, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Also, the rest of this conversation is going to be on Patreon. So if you want to hear the rest of the conversation Gene and I had, where we go on about creating our own show with Doug Lane, where we watch Tyler Perry movies and give a critique of them. It wasn't just Tyler Perry we talked about. We definitely talked about Tyler Perry. So thank you guys for paying attention, and I...